welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to this another episode of We're Drunk and We Know Things. We're recording outside for the first time this year.
Hooray!
This is amazing. Yeah, the sun arrived.
It's so hot we've had to move into the shade.
First world Jersey problems.
Yeah, really bad.
Those of you who were listening to last month's episode would have realised that we discovered not so much a gap as a gaping, yawning, cavernous hole.
A pit of despair, if you will.
In Mike's... Oh, nice.
Yeah.
Mike's movie knowledge. Turns out he'd never seen The Princess Bride. So we put it on the poll, rigged the poll, and of course it won. Therefore, without much more mucking about, I'm pleased to announce that this month's episode is one of my childhood favourites, and I think possibly one of Mike's new firm favourites. We're covering The Princess Bride, and if you don't listen to the end, we will be very put out.
That's what I do. I drink. And I know things.
So as you say, we're doing Princess Bride, which I hadn't seen. I wasn't really that aware that I had to see it, to be honest. It never really made much of an impact. I'd heard of it, and I'd heard it was this cult following, but I didn't quite realise the extent of its cult following, if to put it very, very mildly. And I love it. I love it. It's a bit like Karate Kid. I love it. I was like, well, it's just a kid's movie, isn't it? And sort of, yeah, but it's like a million other things as well. It's the most charming film I have ever seen.
It is. It wins you over. It's across the board.
And I tell you, I the same thing, I showed this to my wife the other day because she hadn't seen it either. And I said, just wait till they get to the top of the cliff. Because until they get to the top of the cliff, it's fairly standard. And you're like, oh, this is a kid's film. And then the sword fight, which we'll go into in great detail. The sword fight and Ego's speech about his father's death and that kind of stuff. You're like, oh no, this is something extremely special. In like a 2 minute long exchange between the two of them. Cary Elwes, he's just so charming in it. He's just Douglas Fairbanks. He's like a modern Douglas Fairbanks. It's amazing. I don't know how he hasn't become an enormous superstar and not just being psych all the time.
Yeah, I mean he is a swashbuckler of the First Order, right?
Yeah, 100%.
Lifted straight out of a 30s.
Yeah, he's Errol Flynn, he's Douglas Fairbanks, he's dressed up as Zorro.
Very quick plot summary, because if you haven't seen it, then I know we say this every time, but please go and watch it. You'll probably love it.
Yeah.
It's the story of...
Boy meets girl. A farm owner's daughter... falls in love with a farmhand that works on their farm, who only ever says "as you wish," and he came to realise that every time he said "as you wish," he was really saying "I love you." And then he goes off to like make a whole bunch of money by being a seafarer or something, so that he can come back rich and marry her. And he gets killed immediately by the dread pirate Roberts. So she ends up getting engaged to a prince, Prince Humperdinck, who is played by Chris Sarandon, which is why Susan Sarandon is called Susan Sarandon, because she used to be married to him. Little tidbit there.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. She's not happy. She's not happy about it. And she gets kidnapped. Because Vizzini, who is played by the incredible Water Shore.
She gets kidnapped by this group of three misfits.
Yes. Vizzini, Fezzik, and a lot of Zzz.
The Spaniard, and the giant, and the yeah. really, really, really annoying midget.
The clearly very Jewish Sicilian man.
Yes.
Who is a master criminal and a genius, apparently. They've been contracted to start a war, haven't they, between Gilda and the other place where...
Florin.
Florin, that's it, thank you.
I think Florin is the where she's from, and Gilda is the place across the sea.
Keep in mind, I've actually only seen this film 5 times now, but that was all in the last week. So I watched it 4 times and then watched it
quite fresh, to be
honest. Yeah, it is. I also...
I'm having to dig back into the late 80s here when it was on repeat.
I also read As You Wish, which is the book by Cary Elwes. We don't know how to say his name, so I'm saying it different every time. Cary Elwes has written a book called As You Wish, which is essentially stories from the set. And he was given the call sheets, which are essentially like the notes of the day during the shoot, so he could jog his memory. There's all new interviews in it. If you like The Princess Bride... Even if you don't, if you just like films, I highly recommend this book as a great like memoir of making a movie. It's a brilliant book. Very, very book. And is just as charming as you would expect it to be, having seen this film. I'm going to use the word charming a million times during this podcast.
It's fine. Probably we stay clear of tweet. yeah, so anyway, she's kidnapped.
Yeah, sorry, so she's kidnapped.
As part of the... They're fleeing to start a war. And it turns out they're being followed...
By the Dread Pirate Roberts, who is supposedly killed Wesley, who is her love, her true love. And it turns out the Great Pirate Roberts is Wesley, and then they have to escape to be together. But they don't.
No.
He gets tortured to death with nipple clamps by Mel Smith. That's what happens.
Mel Smith and the other guy.
Christopher Guest.
Glover.
Christopher Guest. Yeah, Christopher Guest. Christopher Guest and Mel Smith gets tortured to death, but he's only mostly dead.
So he gets brought back by Billy Crystal.
Oh my God! So, I mean, that scene is one of the great. It almost feels like its own. It's like a sketch within the film. It feels like its own thing.
I can't remember. This might be one of your trivia points, so forgive me for jumping in. But was it Cary Elwes who said that the only injury he actually got on set was he pulled a muscle from laughing too hard?
That is Mandy Patinkin.
Is it Mandy Patinkin?
Yeah, he bruised a rib trying not to laugh during that scene.
Amazing.
I've actually got some bits on the two injuries that Cary Elwes had during the making of the film, both of which are hilarious stories.
Okay, well, we'll come up with those. Miracle Max brings him back to life.
And then says, have fun storming the castle.
They go off and storm the castle.
Carol Kane and his wife is amazing.
Yeah.
I'm not a witch, I'm your wife! they go off and storm the castle. Pretty big thing we forgot to mention. Inigo Montoya's dad was killed by a six-fingered man, and he's looking for revenge.
I think that's
revenge.
Almost a side plot.
Oh, yeah. It's not like...
Not so, critical to the whole thing.
And handily, the bloke who's marrying a Buttercup, who's playing to murder her, so Wesley has got to save her, he's assisted by the six-fingered man who killed Inigo Montoya's father.
Yep.
Also, Andre the Giant is there because he's a giant and it's fucking awesome. He's pretty much... That's what he said, right? He's the muscle.
Basically, bust up a wedding. Well, they don't quite bust up a wedding.
There is a wedding by Peter Cook being marriage. is amazing.
One,
but they never say I do. He saves a princess. Inigo gets his revenge. They literally ride off into the sunset and have the kisses of all kisses.
Mm-hmm.
The end.
Yeah. So that's the plot of The Princess Bride. And before we get into production, I should point out to our eagle-eared listeners... that we've actually changed venues.
God help us.
Now, we've never had to do this mid-recording before. We met a really nice guy in the Prince of Wales called Sergio, who decided that he really wanted to be famous.
Yeah, and wouldn't accept the fact that we weren't famous.
And that we were the people to get him there.
Yeah.
You'll hear more from Sergio later on in the show, so please listen to the end.
He really wanted to give his opinion on a film that he admitted to us hadn't seen.
So, we are now sat outside the bar and canteen.
Which is extremely pleasant.
Yeah, I mean, they've got fake grass and everything. We've moved up in the world. Anyway, with that slight diversion aside, Mike, The Princess Bride, production thereof.
Don't even remember now. No. Right, so, yeah. Right, yes, quite. Okay, jolly good. Well, first of all, I'd just like to raise a glass to Sergio, because I'm worried that he might be dead at this point. He had a lot to drink. We start early, but good Lord... That man should have a podcast called I'm Drunk. Anyway,
everything.
So I think the last thing I said was that the book had been written by William Goldman, who then wrote a script. He wrote the book for his daughters because they wanted like a fairy tale about how a princess got saved by a handsome prince and that kind of stuff. So he wrote a lovely story for his daughters.
Yeah.
He then turned that into a script and shopped it around to studios. Now, he said he doesn't normally like anything he writes.
So roughly when are we, sorry?
So this is like mid-80s, early 80s. I haven't read the book, I won't lie.
No, I haven't.
Kind of open you, to be honest. Oh, super fan, are we, Rob? Anyway.
Of the movie?
Apparently, we'll come on to the
The books are never better than
We'll come on to the Amazon One Star reviews later, but it's very strange. The reviews of the book are bad. But anyway. So, he shopped it around for ages. Richard Lester tried to direct it, couldn't get it off the ground. Richard Lester, who directed Superman 2. You know, high caliber. And the Beatles movies that my granddad edited, just to drop that in. Francois Truffaut. I don't know if you've heard of him.
Name
rings
a bell.
Small director. He couldn't get it off the ground. Then Robert Redford tried to direct it and also star in it as Wesley. Don't know that it worked. When Robert Redford was trying to direct it, they wanted Andre the Giant, but they couldn't get him. So they were like, what about this bloke? Arnold something. Arnold Schwarzenegger?
What?
Yeah.
So again, parallel universe, there could be a version of this film.
Robert Redford is Wesley.
Starring and directed by Robert Redford. Yep. And with Arnie in the role of Physic.
He definitely wouldn't have been as good.
Amazing.
I mean, Arnie is big, but Andre the Giant is...
Yeah, but this is straight off the back of Conan. This is Conan Arnie.
Well, that's what I'm saying. This is what I said earlier.
Bit of false perspective, we're gonna and we would have been in there.
Hopefully this isn't going to be part of the thing that we cut out, but that's why they marketed it like Conan. But anyway, so, for a very long time, they couldn't do it. I did forget one thing. Christopher Reeve was at one point going to be Wesley.
Again, I can see that.
I can definitely see that. I think perhaps even better than... Robert Redford. Don't forget that William Goldman wrote the script for Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid with Paul Newman and Robert Redford, which is a fabulous film. It's an absolute beauty of a film. So he was very, very protective. So it got to a point where the rights reverted, and William Goldman, being William Goldman, bought the rights back off the studio. I forget which studio. Doesn't matter. Bought the rights back, which is not a thing that happens anymore, but he being William Goldman, playing in the background, sorry.
It's fine.
This is the beauty of our producer being an invisible man this week. We can just keep going without having constant interruptions. Yeah, that's right.
Our producer this week, of course, is the inevitable Eddie the Beard Teach.
Yeah, he's actually on sabbatical for a change anyway.
Remote production values.
Which is so good because we're joking about it and we're going to listen to this back and be like, man, the flapping of that umbrella in the background is a real nightmare. But anyway.
God, you're going to make me put the headphones back on.
No, anyway. So... Rob Reiner had read the book and absolutely loved it. So he made Spinal Tap, and they basically, as they are wont to do, gave him a blank check, a carte blanche. You stop flapping now, you put the earphones on. They gave him carte blanche, and he said, oh, I want to take a crack at that. And they were like, inconceivable. Like, you're not going to be able to do that. Not the last time I'm going to say that. Can't do it, but by all means, go and see William Goldman. So he went to see William Goldman. And they hit it off straight away. And then Rob Reiner and William Goldman rewrote the script together.
Nice.
Yeah, indeed.
Because wasn't this off the back of, like, Reiner had some minor, major success? And he was basically told, yeah, off the back of Spinal Tap, right, go and find your next movie.
Yeah, what do you want to do next?
Don't make it expensive.
It's a story as old as time of a director having a smash hit and then being like, what do you want to do next? Christopher Nolan is a great example of this. Okay, you've made the Batman films. What do you want to do? And he's like... I want to make a movie about two magicians who are having a really big argument, and I want to put David Bowie in it as Tesla, and the studio were like, okay, it's the best. In fact, I highly recommend a podcast called Blank Check, which is a whole podcast about this.
You can't.
I can recommend another podcast.
No, you can't.
It's good.
Are they paying us?
Well, no, but they could.
Right, please, listeners, disregard
that Blank
previous
Check.
Recommendation.
It's good. Let's do it. Rob's in charge of the editing, so none of this is making it. Rubber baby buggy bumpers. Say what I like. Don't know why I chose that. Anyway, let's move on. So, Rob Reiner had seen Cary Elwes Ulues. No one knows how to say his name, not even him. He'd seen him in Lady Jane, which was a period piece, happily enough, about Lady Jane Grey being married to some lord or something. Super snooze fest. Apparently it's fucking amazing. It's all RSC actors. Cary Elwes is amazing, isn't it? Anyway, he'd seen him in this and he was like, that's the guy I want. So Cary was filming a movie in Berlin at the time, like 2 weeks after Chernobyl. So Rob Reiner and his producing partner, Andy something, a surname I should definitely know, but can't be bothered to look up.
I think you're fine.
A longtime producing partner flew to Berlin to go and see him to see if he was right for the part. Apparently when they got there, they like ran in and out of the hotel. They were really scared to touch anything. They wouldn't drink the water. They were so convinced that Chernobyl was so bad, right?
That it's reached Berlin.
Yeah, yeah. So they were so terrified. They were terrified to be there.
Classic American geography
there. Rob Reiner's producing partner, Andy, I want to say Scheinman, but anyway, yeah, him, fun. Apparently just like left all his clothes in Berlin because he was just like, nope, contaminated.
Burn them.
He said he had a $4,000 jacket that he said to this day he's never spent that much money on clothes, and he just left it in Berlin because he was like, nope. Radioactive.
Why would you take it?
Indeed, quite. That was my point. That's what I thought.
Just go in scrubs or something.
So they turned up and they saw him and they just joked around. Cary Elwes very famously did a, unfortunately for this podcast, the timing of it, a Bill Cosby impression of Fat Albert. Hey, hey, hey. That's not him. I don't think it's him. The internet will tell me. Did an impression of him and like they made him laugh, and it was very important to Rob Reiner that they had a sense of humour, but understood that the film had to be played totally straight and the dialogue would speak for itself.
And it is.
Which
right?
It does.
The entire film is straight.
It's not played for laughs at all, but it gets massive laughs. Which is,
because it is hilarious.
It's something I absolutely love. So these cast him, and now they're looking for somebody, and they need a giant. And they're looking for an Andre the Giant type. So they just phoned up on this 15th iteration of trying to cast this movie. They just phoned up WWF at the time, WWE now, and said, what about, is Andre available? And they said, he's got a match in Japan next month, for which he is being paid $50 million.
What?
In the mid-80s.
Wow.
Wrestling was a very, very, well, it is still a big business, but it is bananas. How much Hulk Hogan and him got paid back in there?
That's insane.
I've got so much stuff
anyway, go
about
on.
Andre the Giant, but we'll come on to that later, because I would like to have a small little tribute to him, because he sounds like a saint. But anyway, so, they wanted him, and they said, no, you can't have it. He's got to do that. And they were like, well, we can't pay him $50 million. The budget is 16. Like, today, probably a drop in the ocean, but $16 million budget. So they auditioned Richard Kiel, who is Jaws.
Yep.
Yeah. Kareem Abdul-Jabbar.
Sorry, that's easy for you
Kareem
to say.
Abdul-Jabbar, who was a very, very tall basketball player. He was on the Lakers at the time.
Oh, hang
on,
wasn't he
Roger
an airplane?
Roger in airplane, yeah, yeah. He's Roger in airplane, yeah, yeah. Is it Roger or Over? One of the two. He's a co-pilot in airplane.
He's not Clarence.
He's also in Game of Death, you know, with Bruce Lee. He was Bruce Lee's pupil, that bloke.
Amazing.
Yeah. And then WWF phoned up and were like, oh, no, the match has been cancelled. So they were like, bosh. So Andre, I'm going to have a small, we're going to have a small talk about Andre for a minute.
I'll call right, him
Andre. Andre was born in France and wrestled there. Well, actually moved to Paris, where he got a job moving furniture, where an enterprising person realised that Andre the Giant could do the work of five people and they'd have to pay him for the work of one person. Till he got picked up on the wrestling circuit, moved to Canada, blah, 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 blah. Andre the Giant had an illness that meant he never stopped growing. Now, there are treatments for it, but because his wrestling gimmick was that he was so big, he never sought out treatment for it.
Never got medical
help. Because it was his
help.
Moneymaker.
Yeah.
And he was just in, by this point, even in the 80s, he was in absolute agony because he's constantly growing, right? At the age of, you know, late 30s kind of thing. People were alternately terrified and loved him. Apparently he was one of the most nice, amazing, genuine people in the world. There's the famous story about during the take where they're on the battlements and he's moving Cary Elwes's head around and mm-hmm. everything. And he lets out a fart that, depending on whose story you read, it was either 15 seconds, 30 seconds, 2.5 hours. Like, it was a fart to of history kind of thing.
A fart of gigantic proportions.
Yeah, literally. And apparently Rob Reiner said, like, the whole of production was brought to a standstill. And Rob Reiner just said, Andre, are you okay? And he just said, I am now, boss. Like, this is something that I've been reading a lot about Andre recently. There's a very good documentary just come out on HBO. And he called everyone boss to try and put them at ease at the fact that he could flatten them with his hand, you know?
Yeah.
There's all those stories about how he could drink 120 beers in a night, all that kind of stuff. In fact, the night of the table read, when they first got to London, they went to this beautiful hotel. And they all sat around and did the read. Now, in order for Andre to learn his lines, because of he's got not a speech impediment, but he's got such essentially enormous vocal cords that his voice is very, very difficult to understand. Mm-hmm. Sander.
Anybody like a peanut?
But what they did was Rob Reiner recorded all of his dialogue. So essentially between them, the production staff recorded the entire script onto tape so that Andre could learn it that way. Because he was French, don't forget.
Yeah. You know,
it was his second language. But on the night of the table read, they all sat around drinking, having a good time, whatever. Everyone went to bed. Andre decided that and it wasn't that he just ate and drank a lot. From what I understand, he was a bit of a connoisseur. Like, he really liked the finer things in life. If you're getting paid $50 million a match, you can certainly afford it.
Yep.
And on the way out of the hotel to go to the cab, you can only imagine what the cab driver would have thought. You imagine turning up for a fare and Andre the Giant stood outside. Anyway, he falls down and passes out in the lobby of this very five-star luxury hotel. So the engineers are called, the janitors are called, all the staff are called, and this bloke is out cold, and he's not, and they can't pick him up. They can't even roll him over to put him on a blanket to carry him, to drag him out. So what they did was, and this is apparently at like 9 o'clock at night,
please tell me this is a forklift,
they put a velvet rope around him so that no one would disturb him, just let him sleep.
No, you see, that's it. You've made it.
Imagine leaving a restaurant and actually the biggest person that's ever lived is just passed out in the lobby. I think it's amazing. Apparently he woke up, straightened his clothes, got in a cab, and went home.
Rock and roll.
Yeah, I mean, from what I understand, the many stories that Cary Elwes talks about in his book and all of the other supporting stuff, the making of stuff, the director's commentary, all that kind of stuff. I mean, apparently the man was absolutely, like, his life experience had really, like, made him such a lovely person. He said, kids used to either run away and scream
or grab him. Yeah.
I mean, the stories from all the cast members, where they brought their kids to set, and it was that. They wanted to meet the giant, daddy's working with the giant, and then it would either be an absolute hysterical nightmare or they'd absolutely love him. Apparently when he wrestled in Japan, just as a aside, when he wrestled in Japan, because of the hotel rooms in Japan, he couldn't fit in the bathroom, so he used to, I'm going to lower my voice because there are people eating around, so he used to shit in the bath.
But then this is the problem when you are somebody who is as big. Both physically and...
Yeah.
In personality. And in fame.
Google Andre the Giant beer can. Because there are many pictures of him holding a normal-sized beer can. It is terrifying.
It's like a thimble.
It is crazy. And in fact, there's an amazing photo of Arnold Schwarzenegger stood next to him, which is really, when you really get a sense of... On Conan, because he was in Conan Destroyer as a cameo. And there is a set photo of Arnold Schwarzenegger stood next to him, which is like... What?
What?
So, I should qualify for this, because this isn't going to be the completest guide to The Princess Bride. Because I haven't got the next 3 weeks to sit here and tell you everything that... There is such a massive wealth of information about the making of this film, because it is so beloved, that you could literally talk for hours.
We could do nothing but The Princess Bride for the rest of the year.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. You definitely could. We could literally do a Princess Bride
podcast. Don't worry, we're not going to.
Yeah, we're not going to. We're definitely not going to. But I will move on anyway to some other bits of casting. So Robin Wright was cast a week before. And apparently sat in a summer house somewhere in Los Angeles. They spoke to lots of different actresses, including one who was very high profile and read for it and loved it. And they were like, nah. Apparently the door opened. Robin Wright was stood there, sun behind her, haloed by the sun. And William Goldman, who was very involved in the whole process and was even on set for a lot of it as well, for the filming, just turned around and saw this girl stood in the doorway and was like, that's it. She's the one. She didn't even read. Apparently... It is a bit weird in the book, I must say, about how they gush so much about how beautiful she is. Not a lot of talk about her performance. Cary Elwes does say, and they do say in a couple of other points, that she is really good. I mean, she's the linchpin of the film, right? She's the princess.
Yeah.
She's the Princess Bride. and she is very, very good in this film.
I mean, she gets the intensity right.
Yeah. The desperation and that kind of stuff.
Yeah, you know, and bear in mind that she's called on to do all the hard stuff. Because she has to... genuinely emote when, frankly, all Cary has to do is be cool and
deadpan. Isn't it? Everyone else has to be
Prince
cool
Humperdinck
and
can
funny,
just be a dick. She actually has to work.
She's
for
the
it.
Only one in the film that actually has to have any range, essentially.
Of course, it won't be the last time that she had to work in difficult conditions opposite somebody that she might, you know, dislike.
You mean Blade Runner 2049 with Ryan Gosling?
I've seen more House of Cards, but
I thought we were just going to keep that joke going for a bit, but that's fine. Way to kill a bit.
I don't get the Ryan Gosling hate. I really don't.
No, nor do I. I love the man. I think he's amazing in that. I think Blade Runner 2049 proved he's amazing. It's so good. That scene where they... Oh, you were being facetious. This is a classic Eiffel Tower thing, isn't it?
Or the dynamic range of a plank of wood.
Oh, I think he's brilliant. Anyway, that movie could be the worst film in the history of man, and I would love it. It's a sequel to Blade Runner, for Christ's sake. But, you know, Deakins, so... Deakins FT Dubs!
Anyway. Right, we'll get there.
Oh, we will. Anyway,
so Robin Wright shows
up. Robin Wright. Marriage! Anyway, Robin Wright, she shows up. Mandy Diggin, there isn't really anything about him because he was just awesome, because he is awesome. He said over the years that this is his favourite role that he's ever done. He's the best actor in the film.
Yeah, by quite a stretch.
I've got a couple of little small bits, but then I want to talk about the sword fight, which I will talk about in a little bit more depth, but... The way he delivers that when he first meets a man in black and he's talking about, oh, by the way, you don't happen to have six fingers, by the way, do you? And like that monologue is amazing. And this is what I said to you before, like how for the first 20 minutes until they get up to the top of the cliffs, you're like, oh, this is a children's fairy tale. And then they get to the top of the cliffs, you know, like, oh no, this is something exceedingly different. You know, it's he is so, so good. But yeah, he was cast. Wallace Shawn, who is Vizzini. He's that, look, I'm a bit drunk.
Vinzini?
He's the guy. He's a Sicilian mastermind guy.
Yeah.
So he got cast. Now, just as an aside about Wallace Shawn, went to Harvard, studied philosophy, economics, and American literature, then went to Oxford and studied philosophy and economics. So Wallace Shawn, actual genius. His parents founded the New Yorker magazine. So, while he was in London filming, he lectured at Oxford.
So he is legitimately the smartest person on set.
So yeah, absolutely. I mean, he's a playwright in his own right. He wrote My Dinner with Andre. I don't know if you've heard or seen of that film. Yeah, yeah. Which is a great film, which he wrote. He is an actual legit genius. So he got the job, and his agents turned around and said, it's really good you got the job, because they really wanted Danny DeVito. Alternate universe. I didn't want to mention earlier because this is a good story. So Wallace Shawn, being Wallace Shawn, apparently has got quite bad anxiety and was just convinced they were going to fire him and replace him with Danny DeVito. So every time Rob Reiner said cut, he thought they were going to go, get off the set. When they had to be looking like they were going up the cliffs, they were on top of on a forklift. And they were like 20 feet up in the air, but he's terrified of heights.
Oh,
and it apparently just had, of all the people, he had a terrible time making this film because he just thought they were going to fire him at any moment.
And then they tried to throw him off a cliff.
And then they tried to throw him off a cliff. So apparently during the scene where they're going up the cliff and they're on the forklift, Andre turned round to him and said, don't worry, boss, I look after you. And Andre the Giant had just had back surgery. So actually, that's why if he's ever on someone on his back or he's carrying someone, it's in close-up because he physically couldn't lift up a person, which is something for Andre the Giant because he just had back surgery. So like when she jumps out the window and he catches her, she's on wires. When Carrie Eloise is on his back, when he's choking him out, he's actually on a platform at the back. So when he bangs him against the rock, that's a stunt double and that kind of stuff. Yeah, yeah.
I did not know that.
Yeah. So apparently Andre really looked after Wallace Shawn, which you can you imagine? I mean, Wallace Shawn is like, what, 5'3"? You know, 5'4"?
Anyway. Yeah, tiny, tiny man. And the scary thing is I was watching this last night with my wife, who also loves this film,
my wife, by the way.
And she said he's one of those characters, and this is such a perfect summing up. He's one of those characters that you... spoiler alert, you are so glad that he dies.
I mean, that scene is so good.
But you kind of wish he hadn't.
Yeah.
Because he is so entertaining in every scene he's in.
That scene where he talks to the man in black about the poison. But that is what you think a foolish man would do. And like, it's so good. It's so fast-paced. And all Carrie has to do is sit there and just kind of nod and smile like, and be charming. And yeah, he just has this whole monologue. So apparently that's the first thing they filmed. So he said,
that was their introduction to the movie.
Literally, he said, for a man that was already nervous about whether he's going to get fired, his biggest, most complicated scene, not the best thing to shoot first. And Rob Reiner just said he just had to spend all of his time saying, we're not going to fire you, just calm down. So yeah, so like I say, I could legit talk all day, but I'm not going to. You'll be pleased to hear. I would like to mention a couple of accidents before we talk about the sword fight. So the accidents, Carrie Eloise.
I think the L is silent.
Is it just...
It's Carrie...
I think it's Carrie L's. Yes. Never had him say it. Listen, if you're listening, Carrie, I'm sure you are.
Just
give me a ring. Yeah. My number is...
We'll update your Wikipedia article with pronunciation.
That's good.
Wouldn't kill you.
The pronunciation thing on Wikipedia doesn't make any sense, by the way.
No.
It's just random symbols. Anyway, so, because Andre Giant was Andre the Giant, he couldn't fit in any of the transpo trucks. So when they were driving around on the top of cliffs and up hills and everything in England, he couldn't fit in them. He also couldn't walk because he was in so much pain. So they bought him an ATV. Let me just paint a word picture for you, Rob. So there's a truck driving up a hill with all the cast in it.
Yeah.
Being raced and circled and whooped bat by Andre the Giant on a goddamn four-wheel drive ATV, whipping it all around everywhere, having the time of his life, probably drunk off his ass, let's be frank. So apparently one day, for a lot of the shooting, he kept saying to Carrie, listen, you've got to have a go, boss. Boss, you've got to have a go. Boss, you've got to have a go. So one day, he's dressed up as the man in black. He's feeling a bit bold. He's like, I'll have a go. Immediately hits a patch of rocks, gets his foot stuck between the bottom of the ATV and a rock, and near enough tears his toe off and breaks his toe. So this is like 3 weeks into filming. And he's like, oh my God, I'm going to get replaced. So just tries to man up through it. They strap him up, they put a splint on him, all that kind of stuff. So if you look when he sits down, when he's talking to Buttercup, he's always got one leg outstretched.
Mm-hmm.
It's because his foot hurts so much. So there's loads of bits in the film when they're
outside.
He's broken
his foot.
He's broken his big toe. So he was desperate that no one tell Rob Reiner. And eventually, apparently, Rob Reiner that night came over and said, when were you going to tell me? And he said, listen, we're a family. You've got to tell us these things. And that is the big thing of this book, is that it starts off, using a word you don't want me to use, it starts off feeling a bit twee, the book, frankly.
Yeah.
But then by about halfway through, you're like, oh, no, it was actually, like, a lovely time. It really, clearly, like, the making of the film clearly was just as charming as the rest of it. It's amazing. It really is amazing. I'm in love with this thing. It's a nightmare. The other thing, the other injury he had, was you know when the six-fingered man, who I forget his name, knocks out Wesley?
Oh, I know this one. I know what you're about
to
tell me.
It's a real sword. So he just whacks him on the
he
head
really
and just knocks him out cold.
He concussed him.
Apparently he woke up in A&E with the same doctor who had splintered his toe being like, you're a terrible
dude,
action star,
what
mate.
Are you doing?
It's so funny. Knocked him out cold.
But apparently that was Rob Reiner told him to do that.
Yeah, well, they were saying, like, because the DP kept saying, like, oh, no, you can tell he's not hitting him. So Rob Reiner and Carrie said, listen, you can tap me on the head. It's fine. I'll be okay. And he just cold-cocked him and knocked him out. To knock someone out, hit him on the top of the head, you've really, not the jaw, behind the ear or something, on top of the head. Anyway, yeah. Mm. So this brings us to my last production piece, which is the sword fight. The sword fight to end all sword fights, as William Goldman called it. So in order to make it the greatest sword fight of all time, they got the greatest movie sword fighters of all time, well, arguably, to help. Bob Anderson and Peter Diamond.
So these are ex-Hollywood sword fighting maestros, choreographers.
One is a lifelong stuntman and sword fighter. One is an Olympic champion sword fighter.
Oh, right, so actual proper fencer.
Bob Anderson... and Peter Diamond.
Also, that's what his friends call him, Bored Bob Anderson.
Because
he's just uninterested by everything.
He hates it.
Unless it's sword fighting.
Ironically, no, I even hate that. But they were the sword fighting people, teacher people from Star Wars. Bob Anderson, when Darth Vader's having a sword fight, there's Bob Anderson in the costume.
What?
Yeah. Bob Anderson, who died a couple of years ago, was the sword master for Lord of the Rings.
Oh.
Pretty good pedigree. Oh. Pretty good pedigree. There's a lot of Star Wars crossover because don't forget it was shot in England, this film. So like all the little people inside the rats of unusual size were all Ewoks, for example.
Not much difference, to be honest.
Indeed.
They're annoying and do very little to further the plot.
So when they got the roles, when Mandy Patinkin, I'm moving straight on.
Yeah, not right to that one.
When Mandy Patinkin and Carrie got the roles, they went, cool, so you got the roles. Next week, you have to meet with the Swordmasters. So Manny Patinkin had studied fencing.
I was
going to
say, he must have studied it beforehand.
Manny Patinkin has studied sword fighting at Harvard for a month beforehand and had become quite adept. But, you know, essentially what it was, they said, we have to make you look like you are the greatest sword fighters in the world and sword fighters can't tell that you're not. So as tradition holds, when sword fighting in the Errol Flynn movies and that kind of thing, it's all close-ups, right? Long shots of stunt doubles.
Yep.
Rob Reiner said... it's all long shots. We'll have a couple of close-ups, but it needs to be very evident it's you doing this.
Yep.
Right? So other than the somersaults and the spinning over the bar, who is, again, an Olympic athlete, seems reasonable to let him do that. But all of the sword fighting was them. So they studied for 3 months, every day, 9 to 5. So they were like, oh, that's cool, so we'll learn. And they said no. So they split them into pairs, and they took one each, essentially, Mandy and Carrie. And every down moment on set, they were there. So they say, cut, right, Carrie, that's you for the day. You know scenes tomorrow.
Four months
would be standing there with a sword going, practice. Practice. So they just practice and practice and practice and practice and practice. Apparently Mandy Patinkin has kept it up. He's kept his tip up.
Still fences. Amazing.
It's really bad, but this, you know what I'm like for my hobby du jour. Movie kind of makes me want to learn fencing. Anyway, reading the books and all this kind of stuff, I'm really like, it's cool, man.
I think you should. I think it's cool. You should. I'll learn archery, and then we'll see who wins.
Well, yeah, so they practiced unendingly, an amazing amount. When Carrie Elwellers broke his toe, they just did all handwork. They just got him to stand in one place, and he just did all handwork and stuff. He didn't get out of it. It was just tough, mate. You've got to keep going. So on the day it came to film the sword fight, they had the choreography down so pat that it was a minute long. And they needed at least 3 or 4 minutes. So Rob Reiner on the day is like, right, get the production guys in. We need to build a big, like, ruiny bit that they can fight up a staircase. We need a bit where he jumps around a bar. We need somersaults. We need extra bits to pad this out. They practiced so much and they were so good, they could literally make it up within 48 hours' notice and extend this sword fight. So all the stuff where he's fighting up the rocks, mm-hmm. when they're knocking over the walls and like all that stuff about, I know something you don't, I'm not left-handed. All that stuff, dialogue was in there.
Was added, oh, right.
All the extra physicality stuff, knocking over the wall and jumping and all that kind of, the back flip landing on the obvious pad under the sand. Those are the best, by the way. I love those. I love those in these slightly older movies. All that stuff was made up within 40 hours' notice. It's amazing. It really is amazing.
It is insane. And again, it's something that I said to various people, anyone who'll listen, that if you want to know why I love this film, because people will look at it and they'll be like, oh, it's a fairy tale. Why do you like it?
No, but those sword fights are amazing.
Because it has probably one of the best, I mean, to call it modern Hollywood even seems unfair these days, but one of the best modern Hollywood sword fights I have seen.
In comparison to Errol Flynn's.
Ever.
Yeah.
No, this is it. It's pure, it's straight out of Errol Flynn. It's guys who learned how to fence, because why do you learn how to fence? I want to be an actor.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
Christopher Guest versus Manny Patinkin at the end, and Ego, his like, revenge kill at the end. They did it a few times, and Mandy Patinkin kept nicking Christopher, because they're playing real swords, right?
Yeah.
They weren't fucking about. Kept nicking him and bruising him and stuff. So they had to take a week off so Christopher Guest could learn defensive maneuvers so that he could just on the fly, if Manny Patinkin got his blood up too much, he'd know how to parry and how to defend himself. It's just amazing. I mean, the sword fights in this are so, and I'm not a sword fighting guy. You know, we've talked about this before. I'm not a sword and sorcery fantasy guy, but I just think the sword fights in this are inspiring. They are absolutely amazing.
Something that you may not know about me, and our listeners probably don't know about me, or maybe two of them, is I actually studied fencing at school.
No, you didn't.
I did.
What school did you go to?
Are
you 400 years old?
Run-of-the-mill... All right.
just a run-of-the-mill state school.
No, it was run-of-the-mill comprehensive. We had fencing. It was better than PE.
What was it like being Prince Philip's classmate?
You know...
I just watched The Crown. That's why I just got that reference out. Anyway, go on.
And it's something that you say, I kind of want to try this.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
It's like, actually, having tried it...
I bet it's the most...
The acknowledgement of the amount of skill and effort that went into that.
The physical exertion of it must be insane. It must be absolutely insane.
But it's everything. The footwork is perfect.
Yeah, yeah.
Even the silliness where
they
take it up a notch and they do the whole loop, looping around the thing. And then they land and then they deliver.
So that was decided on the day, by
an
the way.
An insane extended duel.
Carrie Elwes said on the day, don't you think that his jump should be better than Inigo's? So he did a loop-de-loop around the bar. And this Olympic gymnast was like, no, I just do a loop-de-loop, we're fine. Just did it off the bat.
Yeah, just done it.
But a lot of the stunts were all done. And this is my closing bits for a production, because otherwise it's going to be 14 hours long. A lot of the stunts were done themselves. So they had stuntmen on set to take over if need be. But like that headfirst dive into the quicksand, for example, that's a trap door that opens like on a flick of a switch. So they practiced it with stuntmen, and then they were like, well, you can tell it's not Carrie Elwes doing it. So he jumps up, dives head first, and they had a lot of trouble getting it past, because they were like, we were ready to do this for two passes. She jumping down, him holding his nose and jumping in like it's water, and then pulling out. And that we were going to do it in one take. So they ended up doing like 20 takes, and one of them was the star of the film diving head first into this hole that has a trap door in it otherwise, you know, that had to open on time. They did a lot of their own stunts, and I think that goes a long way in this film. It really does, like, especially the sword fighting. You can tell it's them, and it just feels good.
You get immediacy, you get connection, and the fact that it's not a lot of, you know, a long shot with a stuntman.
It helps with immersion.
I'm guessing there were stuntmen who, when they fell down the hill.
Yes, yeah. Well, Carrie Elwes had broken his toe.
That's quite obvious.
He literally just broken his toe. Yeah, it's pretty obvious. Yeah, pretty obvious.
Buttercup looks like a man called Steve.
Yeah, I think he's probably the same dude. He's wearing a dress, and then he's wearing the Man in Black thing. To be honest.
So hang on, wait. I've got to do it twice.
Yeah. So that's everything I've. It's not everything I've in production, but we can't be here all day. Well, we can, but no, it's not. Though.
It's a nice day.
It's a nice day.
It's not like we've got another episode to record or anything.
But yeah, that is me. So this brings us on to soundtrack.
Ugh.
Martin Offler did it. There you go.
I mean, this is the...
That's all I want to say. Martin Offler did it. Didn't do a good job.
Yeah, let's move on.
We don't like it. I like the theme. I don't like it.
I kind of want it feels budget. I kind of want that it is budget. It's a 1999 Casio keyboard.
I like the actual theme, the actual main Princess Bride theme. I really like. I think it's very nice. It's very romantic, and it fits very well for the film.
I don't.
The incidental music is bad.
The only thing that I would love for them to do, potentially, I don't know when its anniversary is or something, would be to get the original master tapes.
Yeah.
And basically rescore it. Get Knopfler back in.
Give him an orchestra. Yeah, yeah. Oh, no, that would be amazing.
An actual orchestra.
You know what would be amazing? Princess Bride live with an orchestra.
Princess Bride on ice.
No, just with an orchestra.
Everything's better on ice, Mike. Sure. Anyway, yeah, so the soundtrack is kind of such
balls. No, don't say that, Mike. It's horrible.
It's just a bit synthy. By and large, it gets away with it by staying out of the way. It's no Lady Hawk.
No.
But there are certain moments that if you're listening to the music... Don't, basically, is all I'm going to say.
So moving swiftly on.
Please.
Sequels reboot.
Yeah?
They're not rebooting it, don't worry. I just said that to try and freak you out a bit. William Goldman has been saying that he's been writing a sequel called Buttercup's Child or Buttercup's Lament or something like that for years and years and years, but it's never transpired.
Well, he insists, it's just the Queen divorcee.
He insists that he's writing a sequel novel. Or he might not, I don't know.
Smacks of George R.R. Martin, to be honest. He insists he's writing the next Game of Thrones book. So I'm pretty sure he's full of shit.
There are stage plays, there are video games, there are a million homages online. There was an amazing table read recently where Jason Reitman, who is Ivan Reitman's son, shockingly, he did a table read where he did like Patton Oswalt as Vizzini, Paul Rudd was Wesley, Cary Elwes was Humperdinck. So you know they do these table reads now where you can go to a theatre and see like a cast of people read the story?
Yeah.
So, but it was Cary Elwes was a Humperdinck as like switching roles and stuff, which apparently is amazing. You can watch it on YouTube. I highly recommend it. It's very, very funny. It's really good fun. Jason Reitman does a lot of table reads like that of these kind of movies where he switches up the roles and gets famous comedians and different actors and stuff to come and do it, and they're really, really good. That music's turning up, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, perfect. But then, yeah. So other recommendations. Everything by Errol Flynn. Just watch Errol Flynn stuff. Especially the stuff that's meant to be in England, because it's clearly shot in Mexico. It's amazing.
No, I would say that if you want, explore the swashbuckling side of cinema.
Yeah, yeah, definitely.
And don't judge it.
It's given me a bit of a passion for it, actually.
Do what I do, which is watch it for the sword fights.
I've seen a few bits and pieces of Errol Flynn's work and that kind of stuff, but actually it's given me a little bit of like a... I want to go and give it a bit more of a try, actually. It seems like it... everything by Rob Reiner, Stand By Me, Spinal Tap, Harry Met Sally, just go and watch Rob Reiner movies, they're good. Him in Wolf of Wall Street is amazing. Oh, do you know what's really interesting? Do you know, so when Martin Offler did the music, he said, I'll do it, but you've got to get the cap that you wear in Spinal Tap, that USS something or other cap, into the film somehow.
What?
And Rob Reiner was like, what? But obviously they have the amazing framing device, which we haven't talked about, where Peter Falk and Ben Savage,
it's
hanging
in
up in the back. Yeah, it's hanging up in the bedroom.
I mean, we should probably take a brief moment, if you haven't seen the film. If you have, you may have forgotten that actually it's introduced by Columbo.
That framing device is amazing. He's so good. And that is such a lovely, genuine feeling relationship between a grandfather and son. The grandson doesn't... He's going to pinch my cheek. And all the stuff about, wait, is this a kissing book? Like, all that stuff, that is so lovely. And that's all part... Oh, and we'll come onto that in ratings in a minute. Sorry, we'll do recommendations first. I'm getting ahead of myself.
The only thing I would say about As the Framing Device Goes is take a moment next time you watch it, because there's not masses of Fred Savage and Peter Falk, but pay attention to what's in the background in Fred Savage's room.
It's clearly Christmas as well. There's all Christmas decorations up.
And you've got all sorts of, like, crazy little 80s toys and whatever. I would love to know if there was anything specific behind that set, or if they just
had the only thing shot
a really obsessive dresser.
Those bits are the only thing shot in the States, because obviously Ben Savage, Fred Savage, and Peter Falk. But yeah, so other recommendations. I mean, 80s, fantasy stuff, Dark Crystal, Labyrinth, all that kind of business.
I'd say Labyrinth more than Dark Crystal, but
do you think?
Yeah, it's got the whole real people thing.
It's neither in my bag, frankly. But
Labyrinth
I'm sure
is brilliant.
I have no doubt we'll end up getting around to him at some point, and I'll fall in love with them. But still.
I would say Robin Hood Men in Tights.
Yeah,
if you
so
like.
Cary Elwes's follow-up with Mel Brooks.
Hallwells.
So they wanted Mel Brooks to be... We didn't talk about Miracle Max, Billy Crystal. But they wanted Mel Brooks, and Billy Crystal said to Rob Reiner, why have you got me and not Mel Brooks? And he said, because it will obviously be Mel Brooks.
Mm-hmm.
We need somebody that's going to improvise and be really, really funny, but isn't obviously Mel Brooks, you know, like in Spaceballs, when it's obviously Mel Brooks dressed up as that fake-ass Yoda. But yeah, I mean, I don't know. I can't recommend this movie enough. I mean, which brings us very neatly onto our reviews.
Our reviews first. Okay.
So let's do your
What are we doing out of? I think we have to do it out of 50.
Out of 50?
Yeah, the Pit of Despair goes to 50.
It does. I was saying we could do it out of 11 for Spinal Tap. But no, we'll do it out of 50 because that's actually this film. So let's do 50.
But the difference is 50 is the worst because that will kill you.
Oh.
Yeah. Zero is the best. You see what
I
did
there? An extra complication that we've created to confuse ourselves.
So I'm going to give it... honestly, I kind of have... people say they have a soft spot for this film. This film was on repeat in my house. On VHS.
It has been in mine for the last
It would
week.
Stop, it would rewind, and we would watch it again.
You're wearing out them tapes.
So I've got to give it like a... It can't get more than a 5. It should be a bit less.
You're essentially giving it 45 out of 50. Okay, so you're giving it a 5. Okay.
Or 4.5 stars.
I'm going to give it an 8.
Ooh.
It's brilliant. I really like it. It is a wee bit dated.
Yeah.
It is a film that made me remember my childhood, even though I didn't watch it as a child, which is a very strange experience, to be honest. It made me feel like a kid and made me go, I remember watching this when I was, and I didn't. It reminded me of watching shit like Star Wars and stuff when I was a little boy. It really, really took me back to that. I don't know why. Maybe because it was written by Goldman for his daughters, I don't know. But it was savvy enough, it's savvy enough that it engaged the adult part of my brain as well. And reading the book, reading that Kerry Elwes' book about the making of it and watching all the production stuff and all the making of and watching it with the commentary and all that kind of business, all my normal standard research kind of thing for a film. Everybody says they had a great time making a film and they're a family and they love each other and blah, blah, blah. But you, like...
But for once, it's actually not bullshit.
You really do feel like it's true. It's and maybe I'm just caught up in the fairy tale-ness of it, but it does feel like... They do all love each other. They do all love the experience of making it. They meet up all the time because it's such a cult film. They trot it out every 5 years. There's a 15-year, a 20-year, a 25-year, a 30-year Blu-ray. And every time they do it, all of the cast come out and do new interviews, and it's all fresh and all. The Blu-ray I've got has got a new commentary by Rob Reiner on it. You know, they clearly have a lot of affection for this film, and it made me like the film more.
Well, I think there are. Again, that is testament to it beyond all else. There aren't that many movies where the cast really loved making it and the people really love watching it. It just wins.
I think a lot of that, and it sounds weird, I think a lot of that feels like it's down to Rob Reiner because the kids that were in Stand By Me talk about it in the same way. And I just feel like maybe Rob Reiner, who is clearly a very gifted director, creates these sets which have an absolute... like wonderful feeling of like togetherness.
You think he's basically film Gandalf?
Two weeks before filming finished, Kerry Elwes' grandfather died in England, so they gave him a few days off. He went to sit with him while he passed away. All this kind of stuff. Super downer. Sorry, but and the cast rallied around him and helped him out. And like Andre, he left his grandfather's room when he had passed away, and Andre the Giant was sat in the reception of the hospital waiting for him and was like, "Do you want to go for a drink, boss?" Like
across six chairs.
Yeah, indeed. Yeah. But like, you know, it's just charming.
It is utterly charming.
That'd be such a good place to finish this podcast. But we've still got one-star reviews.
But we can't.
We can't.
Because as much as, bear in mind, I love this film. We kind of knew that you were going to love this film. There must be people out there who don't like this film.
And that brings us to one-star reviews.
It's Amazon one-star reviews.
There are 7,500 reviews of this film on Amazon.
7,500?
And then it becomes quickly apparent that for some reason, the movie and book reviews are mixed in together.
Oh, Amazon customers.
And it's like, how do you want to filter it? Do you want to filter it by book and audio or visual and anything else? And I'm like, yeah, sure. But it didn't let me actually filter, which was a real pain in the ass. But having said that, of the 35 odd pages, it took me maybe 17 pages before I found a negative review, because all the one star reviews are like, the Blu-ray shit or whatever. So I finally
Which
found
Blu-ray?
Some. Oh, no, all of them. There's been so many Blu-ray releases of this movie, it's insane. So I finally found some. Susanna, 2016, December. Awful. Total review, awful. But she also gave a one-star review to Groundhog Day. Now, I like Princess Bride. This is what we discussed. Groundhog Day is a legit masterpiece.
Yeah. I think it's weird. I can see you we'll not liking one.
Yeah,
anyway. I can see you not liking the other. To not like both, basically, Susanna, you're tired of life.
And then we have MM from August 2016, who says, Juvenile. Just MM, not M&M. Maybe. But anyway, he says, Juvenile. That's all he said. I was struggling to find people.
They're verbose,
really,
these guys, aren't they?
KK19, August 2015. They said, useless, pointless, waste of time, although I don't watch films, and a group of kids 12 years old seem to enjoy it.
So he basically
so
bought
like
this for a party.
And kids enjoyed it. Yeah, one star, why not?
Yeah. A group of kids, not just his kids.
Like, Kevin Willis, this could have gone either way for me. So Kevin Willis in January 2017 said, hated the movie. It's not Amazon's fault. Just stupid people at work saying the movie was the best thing since sliced bread. Which I get, because I was fully prepared to absolutely hate this film and have the world's most awkward podcast.
Well, this is the problem, that is that you will get, if you go out on the street having not seen it, and you say, stop five people and say, should I watch The Princess Bride? You're going to get gushed on.
Yeah. Of course.
I mean, there's going to be lots of gush all over you.
Kevin Willis did also give Suicide Squad 4 stars, so Kevin Willis can... Kevin Willis can fuck himself.
Just remind me, do we like Suicide Squad
no,
or
we
not?
Don't. Or
okay,
do, or
we
do
don't.
You, do you like Suicide Squad?
I didn't mind it, to be honest, but I've not watched it again, so there you go. That probably says everything you need.
I watched it drunk, which I thought was probably optimum viewings.
I've watched The Princess Bride, a movie that I have probably seen close to 100 times, twice in the last 4 days.
Yeah.
I've not watched Suicide Squad since I watched it the
first time. I
watched
it once and it was a bad time. Yeah. It was one of my famous drunken Facebook live streams. Famous between, like, three of our friends. Anyway, now this is my favourite one, and I think it speaks for itself. I'm not sure, I mean, I'm sure we will have commentary for it, but it doesn't actually need any. So, Justin Hensel, calling you out, bro. Should we be using these people's real names? Anyway.
I don't think... No. Should they be using their real names is the question.
Justin Hensel from May 16 said, Fire Swamps... Giants, big moles,
rats.
Not any big
moles.
Clearly
rats.
Are you kidding me? This movie is completely out of touch with reality. Well, yeah. You know what, actually? I said this requires no commentary. I'm going to pause throughout this commentary just to say. Anyway, this movie is completely out of touch with reality. Add to the fact that rich, spoiled princesses never fall in love with poor stable boys. How many rich poor princes do you know?
Also, she wasn't a princess when she fell in love with the stable boy.
She's just a daughter of a farm owner.
She was a daughter of the local
landowner.
Fundamentally
misunderstood this film.
Unbelievable.
And this movie basically becomes a fairy tale. Yeah, you've hit the nail on the head there, mate. It is a fairy tale.
Is he describing it or criticising it?
Fairy tale, anyway. Oh, and I can't even begin to describe how racist it is to portray a Sicilian as some kind of crime boss.
Actually,
it's true.
That is a fair point. And a Spaniard is a drunken, useless idiot.
Can I just point you at The Godfather and Goodfellas and everything Martin Scorsese has ever made?
Yeah.
Okay.
Well,
you're fine.
There are
racist.
Quite a lot of crime bosses in Sicily.
Yeah, indeed.
That does not say that there isn't a stereotype.
What a hateful stereotype. The Sicilian people are crime, but no, it's... Okay, fine.
They also make really good pizza. Bastards.
Let alone that stereotype being tacky and overused.
It's like mentioned once.
I was hoping for more realism in this movie.
It's literally mentioned. In fact, no, stop. It's literally mentioned once.
It is. He literally
in
says...
In one of my favourite lines of the entire movie, what was it? You made one of the greatest mistakes of all time.
Underestimating a Sicilian.
The first of which being, never get involved in a land war in Asia. The second of which being, never go up against a Sicilian when death is on the line.
So he said, I was hoping for more realism in this movie. Well, I don't read the back of the DVD, I guess. I don't know. But when I saw Master Swordsman riposte during the fight with some scrub pirate, I lost all hope. Now, I'd like to point this out to you, Justin Hensel, that all of the attacking and defending maneuvers that they use in the sword fighting scene are real.
Yes.
Are actual 17th century, honest to God, fencing tactics. So try to big yourself up as a swordsman, mate. Sounds like you're more of a pork swordsman. I'd love to say that I had that prepared, but I didn't. Save yourself some time and watch Red Sonja, the famously realistic. It's so perfect. It's like a parody of a review. It's the best thing. Save yourself some time and watch Red Sonja, the famously realistic medieval movie. I think Red Sonja is good. I like Red Sonja.
Really not.
Oh, I like Red Sonja.
And the same with that Conan's good, but it's not good.
Yeah, I mean, good in the way that it's Red Sonja.
This is just good.
So yeah, so that's one star reviews. And that, my friends, was The Princess Bride.
There is one thing we forgot to do.
Oh, God.
Well,
normally,
we're recommending movies. Right. And I know this is normally your bit, but there is one that sticks in my mind. Ooh. That if you absolutely adore strong leading characters, a touch of fantasy, a little bit of magic, some of the best swordplay you will ever see, then you kind of have to bear at least a little bit in mind Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon.
Some would say it's the Asian Princess Bride. No, no one would say that. Nope.
So there we have it. Inconceivable or otherwise, we've reached the end of The Princess Bride. We've been driven out of a pub by a drunken local.
This has been the most work I've ever done for a podcast.
Yeah, that was a lot of walking.
It was. It was a good 400 metres.
Crazy. This has been We're Drunk We Know Things. We're now recording in the bar, drinking a combination of Bohemian Lager, and Liberation's Craft Lager. Liberation clearly need to get somebody from the Butcombe marketing department to name their beers.
It's good on a hot day, though. Without giving them too much of a plug, Liberation Craft Beer on a hot day is the jam.
This episode was produced in absentia by Eddie the Beard Teach, who will be back to produce our next episode. Meanwhile, we'll see you again next time when we're doing Q. This is going to get interesting.
Jesus, Mary, Mother of God.
Until then.
Hello to you all. Can you hear me? You can hear me. I'll say hello to you all. I love these boys. Mike and Robin Hood. Robin Hood, right?
Yep.
To life, for life, into life. Yeah?
Cool.
I love you guys. These guys are beautiful. They are extremely nice people to me. You guys are nice to me, aren't you?